Hello and welcome to Only Fools and Brotherly Forces, the Only Fools and Horses Rewatch podcast, with myself, Jamie, and my brother, Bobby.
Good evening, Jamie. How's it going?
Really, really well, mate. I think it's important that we first of all address a week's worth of absence. So we didn't actually get to release a podcast last week. Unfortunately, we both were just crazy busy with commitments. I'm still in New Zealand at the moment. I was gearing up to shoot a friend's wedding this weekend and travelling all over the place. And honestly, we tried, but it just wasn't really feasible. And then you were going through the thralls of a promotion. So our schedules just didn't really line up, unfortunately.
It's always going to be difficult on different sides of the world because you only have a few hours where it's realistic, you know, like 7 till 10.
Doesn't become massively unsocial.
Yeah, it's not ideal. But you're travelling back to England next week and we're going to just bank lots, so we're going to be on it.
So back in England from Wednesday, from the day after the day of the podcast release, and just going to be smashing through them again. But the point at hand, on a little bit of a classic episode, A Touch of Glass.
I think we're allowed to say on this one. I think we can say one. Classic. It's a classic.
But I really enjoyed the episode more than I remembered. I thought there were a load of really short fire jokes on this, lots of constant small funnies that really kept it ticking along. Lady Ridgemere didn't annoy me nearly as much as I thought she would.
Oh, really?
And I thought it was a really nice complete episode.
Can stand her. But yeah, I agree. I think it was a good episode and it ticked along really nicely. It's good. I'm looking forward to it. Let's get into it. Stick a pony in me pocket. I'll fetch the suitcase from the van. So we open to some lovely, unfamiliar countryside scenes, just completely out of our comfort zone with Only Fools and Horses. Looks lovely, but there are signs for a place called Irwin Minster, and we find out that's that's where these guys are. It's in Dorset. I have googled it. It was a real place, Irwin Minster. And they're in Dorset at an auction. And they've picked themselves up what Del seems to think is a deal. Can't say I'm convinced, but
I do wonder how many things that must have been at the auction. I mean, I haven't written any notes on this, but I mean, there must have been loads of stuff on the auction, and he's walked away with what I counted about 50 boxes worth of cats for £1.25. I mean,
he's planning on selling them for a fiver, right? And let's say there's 50 of them, that is quite a lot of profit. But there's no way he's going to sell 50 of them for a fiver. If he ends up, he said he paid £1.25 each. I mean, are there many people in a Peckham market who are going to pay £2 for a cat that sings "How much is that doggy in the window"? I just don't see it.
They're just ugly. They're really, I mean, they look even old for the period that we're in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They look naff. I don't know. Maybe then. Now they're almost kitsch.
Yeah, they probably go really down well in like China and Korea and places where they really love model cats.
That's where it was made, right? It says it's like North Korea's finest porcelain. Yeah. Very odd. I mean, it's a three hour drive from Peckham to Dorset. I checked. So yeah. I mean, you've really got to think it's worth it. But apparently, he did.
Well, the 3 hour drive is quite interesting because what he does is decide to jam Grandad into the car in between these boxes. It's not a massive space, and I did the same. I was curious how far the drive was. So they're planning a 2 hour, 45 minute, 3 hour drive back to London with Grandad sardined into the back of the yellow van.
Literally using the doors to keep him in there. Can't be comfortable. But it's a very odd scene, this next one, because they're driving around the English countryside, something we've never seen before. But it's a very, I think, you know, kind of like wanky film paper thing to say, like, it's a very nice juxtaposition of really pretty countryside, very nice, very quaint, and then you've got the grotty van kind of chugging along, tons of smoke coming out the back, and Del making a load of really crude jokes about eating dogs.
I really liked it. You got all the yellow daffodils in the foreground.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
And the yellow van going along. And like I said, the audio is laced over the video. So it's actually really nice sort of art deco.
Yeah, it's odd.
Feel to it. I did really like it.
It was very weird. I've heard an interesting thing recently, actually, about
David Jason saying the having all the smoke. I don't know if he was specifically referring to this episode or just in general, but specifically all the smoke coming out of the van was a thing that he actually did, because of course he used to be, I say of course, not everyone knows this, but he used to be a mechanic before he was an actor, and so he knows a decent amount about cars, and so he had the idea that if you just, you know, if you just spray some oil in the right places, like, I don't know, in the carburetor, I think it was, then it would just create a ton of smoke, and he thought it would look cool and make the van look even more knackered. So that was something that he did just on his own back, because he thought it would be funny, which I imagine, which is definitely taking place here.
Yeah, and that sort of runs a really good theme throughout the show as well. So the van approaches a lady flagging down the car. Dale's not really up for it, but Rodney's insisting that it's a good idea. And, you know, he gets in, he's having a chat, but very quickly learns that she is Lady Ridgemere. And obviously just instantly starts to sink his teeth in and, you know, kiss her boots or whatever analogy you want to use. You know, it's, you know, instantly cringy.
Yeah, it's interesting, the whole, as soon as he hears the word lady and that there's this big house up the road, which they'd already seen, and that's what Granddad mentions. I don't know if you checked, but I did. It is a fictitious mansion, and the title is, not true. Yeah. But yeah, of course, it's there are lots of these types of things around. But yeah, he's all on it straight away, and she's fairly unpleasant straight away as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think I actually made the note a bit later on, but there's no reason to not say it now anyway. As they talk, I think it was this part that I first noticed it. They do seem like the three main characters are kind of overemphasizing the cockneyness a little bit throughout some of the episode.
Oh, you reckon?
Like on this bit, Granddad. Yeah, on this bit, Granddad says, I'll quote it because you can see what you think.
Ridgemere Hall, that's that big mansion what we passed, Dale.
It is almost like like cliche, old school, please sir, can I have some more Cockney London? And then a bit later on when we get to it, Dale says something. There's just a couple of things where I don't know if they did it intentionally as like a contrast to the higher and lower class, or if the flip of that, I was noticing it more, but it just seemed a little bit more played on in places.
Maybe it's more noticeable because of that, to be honest, but it would be, I mean, if you had like a week, you could sit down and compare the kind of grammatical inaccuracies with this episode with others, but I feel like it's them standing out because they're talking to someone like that, because I think the amount of the Cockney rhyming slang and the way they talk and the inaccuracies, it's, once you're kind of with them for just a minute or two, you just kind of fall into it and you just don't even notice. I didn't think I noticed them being particularly worse, but yeah, it would be a thing you could definitely do to play it up. I was just going to say one other thing about Lady Ridgemere. I did a quick Google, and she played one other character as well, which you would definitely remember. Very small character.
You love looking at other roles of
X-Men. Yeah, and absolutely. I always check out like every character, what else they've
done. Did you recognise her, or you were just...
No, I didn't recognise her at all. I just checked them out. I just felt like the lady, Lord and Lady Ridgemore, were quite large parts. I thought they must have done something else interesting, but none of them really had, except for her. She was in a Fawlty Towers episode.
It's funny you say that, because it seemed like the only thing that she could have been done.
You remember the boy who's complaining about the chips being the wrong shape, and is a complete pain in the ass. She's the mother who's like, oh, he's so smart and clever, that's why he's a massive prick. So yeah, she plays the mum.
Oh, as soon as you said that, it just instantly made that connection.
Yeah,
that's crazy,
because it's a similar sort of role of her just being a pain in the ass. So
these eggs look like you laid them. They're the wrong shape.
Oh dear, what shape do you usually have? Mickey Mouse shape? Smarty shape? Amphibious landing craft shape?
We were actually talking with some friends the other day. You know, we plan to go a distance with this one, and we have flirted with the idea of you know, where we might go on from this, just as personal projects, because, you know, we have a good laugh, and I don't think that we could stop doing it once we started, so I think there was a little shortlist for a couple of things. Fawlty Towers might well be on that shortlist, or Blackadder. You know, it's got to be a British sitcom. So
yeah,
I think I would love to go through Fawlty Towers. I actually I sat down with a couple of brothers. So one of our good friends who's been sort of listening to this from the start, and he's also a massive fanatic on sitcom stuff. And, you know, we put the early stuff through him and chatted about it. And he came around the other day with his brother, and they are geniuses at Fawlty Towers, like to the most ridiculously impressive level. Like I like to think I'm pretty good at Only Fools, but somehow his knowledge for Fawlty Towers, even though it's like a much smaller amount of episodes, you would have been so impressed. Like they were asking questions, and I thought I knew Fawlty Towers pretty well, and it was just like I can't even think of an example of one of the things that they were saying. Like it was like numbers on doors and the what was the other thing? It's like they knew the name of the actor who played the mayor, like a really crazy name. I was so impressed, and I was just like, wow, okay, I'll have to brush up on some of my Fawlty Towers.
But it's anyway, been a long time since I properly sat down and watched a few episodes of Fawlty Towers, so I'd be all over that. But anyway, moving on, they've decided to help out Lady Ridgemere, and they tow her back to her manor, where they're greeted by the joy that is Wallace, the butler of the manor, who's also just a sour old goat.
I love him. I love his name. I just think it's a great cliche butler name.
It's definitely a butler name, yeah. He reminded me of, he's literally the incarnation in real life of, well, not real life, obviously, but of the butler in the original Lara Croft PlayStation game that everyone used to lock in the freezer. Is that a reference? I don't know how many people are going to get that reference. It's pretty specific. It might be a 1% of that one. But just like a diddery old bumbly grey-haired person who it'd be funny to lock in a freezer.
Oh, that's very funny.
Del Boy sees an opportunity. That's what this is basically all about. That's why he's helped her out. And, you know, Rodney's ready to leave. And Del Boy's like,
go? What do you mean, go? You don't think I'm leaving here without so much as a cucumber sandwich and a cup of the Earl Grey, do you? This is fate, Rodney. Unison, opportune air. There's got to be an earner in it.
I wrote the same note, actually. I wrote that Dale's next opportunity is vocalised here. We talk about it quite a lot, but he quite literally says here, you know, there's got to be an earner in it.
Yeah.
And he's just like, that's it. He is game on. He is bloodhound looking for where he's going to make money.
Yeah, he hasn't got the faintest idea where it's going to be. But he knows there's got to be something. You don't just suddenly be parked outside in a state like a manor house without some sort of opportunity arriving. But, you know, that's Del.
So we get into the living room and Del's chatting shit about the painting. He misses the artist. It's actually quite interesting because although he mispronounces it to what is largely accepted in England, it's actually a much closer to the proper pronunciation of Van Gogh than what we actually say. A lot of people are going to say Van Gogh, which is massively not even close to what the Dutch say. So it was actually accidentally more
correct. Yeah, he says cough, though, right?
Interesting thing for you there.
Yeah, Van Gogh.
But it's correct, but in Dutch it's Gogh, so yeah. It's pretty close. He's very comfortable, though. He said that he's welcomed anywhere, you know, in the pubs and the clubs, but also in the higher establishments and the regattas, which isn't entirely true. But he's walking around with the house without a care. He's sort of flicking ash wherever he feels like. And there's just a really mad disconnect between him looking and either feigning discomfort or just not having the intellectual capacity to actually have the behaviour of the area. So even though he's comfortable, he just has no idea how to behave in the environment properly. And like Lord Rizmir is sort of like following him around with the ash, and he's just picking up everything around and looking at the bottom of it, trying to find a score somewhere. It's just kind of a bit of a madness circus going on.
That's the thing. It's like he says he's comfortable. I do believe he is comfortable. He's comfortable because he doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know that he's being completely inappropriate. I mean, it's actually quite admirable. Like, wouldn't it be nice to just be able to feel at home anywhere because you just don't realise what a twat you're making of yourself? That I imagine that's quite a nice feeling. That you need so much confidence to pull that off, and that is absolutely what Del Boy has. Like, he doesn't... He thinks he has the polite airs and graces because he knows not to fart or tell a dodgy joke. But really, he's, as he's always doing, running around a room, like you say, touching everything and taking it over. Yeah, he properly makes himself at home, gets himself the large brandy. I love that little joke he makes about that Wallace gives good measures, you got to watch him. Like, it's just, like you said at the start, there's a lot of those very little laughs in this episode. I find there aren't that many big laughs, of course, apart from one very big laugh. There's a lot of these small comments. It's quite good. I really like that about this episode. I think it's a bit different.
Yeah, for me, this is now like a full-on Leonard Pierce 5 minutes. When he sat down there anyway, he's just like bumping everything that Dell says. He's basically just shooting down, you know, from earlier when he said he was driving for John Player specials and he said he was delivering fags. Mm-hmm. And now they're sat down and he's just like everything that anyone says, he's just really direct and truthful.
Yeah, just honest, isn't he, basically?
In his response.
He's just honest. Yeah. Like, it's just like
painful honesty.
He's so unaware of the game that, Delboy is just, yeah, on his way. Rodney is at least trying to appear couth, and he's actually better at it than Del in a way, because I feel like he's genuinely trying to be polite.
Always.
And Grandad, bless him, just hasn't got a clue. He's never been... He looks so out of place. They look like they've just pulled a tramp off the street and chucked him in the living room. Like, he just has no idea what to do in a situation like this.
Del exclamates a French phrase and says, "Mon Dieu," which is my God, and decides to sneak away to go and get this cat. And I really like this dynamic of having Grandad and Rodney in a room with some extras without Del around. I don't think that we see too much
good
of it.
Shout.
Like, we see Grand and Rodney together, but the interaction without Del there is a kind of a little bit more of a unique dynamic. And again, it's brilliant because Leonard Pierce is doing exactly the same thing. And I think it's a hats off to Leonard Pierce moment. I don't think that he has one of his legendary lines really in this episode, but in this particular moment, what he's doing is delivering a continued response to everything that Rodney says, but is making it feel genuine and organic. It doesn't feel forced. And even though the lines are almost written, I won't say cheesy, but it's not cheesy. And it's just a real masterclass because Nicholas Lyndhurst is like uncomfortable and bumbling through and very introverted and trying to be polite. And if you watch Leonard Pierce's face while he's doing it, he's just like deadpan, and he just hits his cues from everything that Nicholas Lyndhurst is doing brilliantly, and it's just like boom joke, boom joke, boom joke, and it's just a brilliant moment. Like, it's just so seamless and felt really really natural. I just loved that little exchange between them there.
Yeah, like you say, the jokes are almost obvious in the way they're cliched, but his delivery, just even though you know kind of the thing he's going to say something to cock up the situation, you've even got a good idea of the kind of thing it's going to be, yet it's still incredibly funny, and that's just 100% down to delivery. Yeah, he is fantastic. The funniest thing, well, the most interesting thing I took away from this was the price that he said the council will give them for their flat. You got that, I assume.
Yeah, I was just on my next note as well to say that the flat was, they could buy it for $8,000.
$8,000, I mean, Jesus, you can't get a car for $8,000. It's insane.
I can't remember what the value is on the last few episodes, because they do buy the house. I'm pretty sure it's around about $100,000. I don't know if it's just over.
Oh, do they give a price?
Yeah, I think so. I was channel flicking when I was back in the UK a couple of weeks ago, and the very last episode was on not Time on Our Hands, but the I think it's called Sleepless in Peckham, the very last of the additional ones they did. And I can't remember if the money that was in there was talking about the stuff they had to pay for the house, but I'm pretty sure it is. But I don't know those episodes very well, but I'm going to assume that it was that my memory is correct, and it was around about $100,000. So it's kind of less a massive inflation, obviously, over the course of what 20-25 years.
I think even now that would be,
but I can't believe
that $100,000 for, even if it's the, you know, in a not very nice area and quite crappy, it's still, I mean, it's got a large living space, a decent sized kitchen, and 3 bedrooms. That thing is worth a lot more now.
Yeah, I mean, this was, even when we're Sleepless in Peckham, like, this is not getting towards 20 years ago now, even for that last episode.
Yes, at least 10, 15.
The last episode.
Oh, the last episode was, yeah, 20 years ago at least, maybe 25, and then it was like a 5-10 year gap in the next. I mean, this is things you'd think we might know, but I definitely don't.
No, definitely a little bit more foggier in the last episodes. But either way, at 8K, I'm surprised that they never sort of had the foresight or idea to try and actually buy it before. It seems like a steal for the money that some of the prices, the deals that they're doing throughout the show. They probably could have bought that a few times over. Because if you are the best, but you don't ask
questions, then brother, I'm your man. We come back into the hall where Lord Ridgemere, who we've not really discussed beyond the fact that he was running around after Del trying to keep his ash away, but has come across as, you know, much more civil than his wife, at least openly so, although he's also very unimpressed that they're there and trying to get rid of them. He is slightly better at keeping up appearances. He's having an argument on the phone about some chandeliers that need cleaning. Has a short exchange with Del, who then hides around the corner to listen to this phone conversation. And this is it. This is Del's opportunity. He finally finds the moment where there might be the earner.
I actually thought that this was, I don't know if it was poorly, I think it has to be poorly written. I don't think you can really act around it.
Well, but really?
The lines were so spoon-fed. Like the way he was like, oh, of course I know it's Louis XIV. Of course I own this thing, French crystal, yes. And it's like, it was just like they gave you all the lines that you needed to build the story. But I don't think they were written particularly well, and that you could only deliver those lines in that way. So I think it was a bit lazy, or maybe a bit of a shortcut. As always, there's time constraints, but that just a little bit there just felt really, I don't know, cabaret, whatever you want to call it. It's just a little bit off for the rest of the pace of the episode.
Yeah, they definitely made it easy for him, didn't they? But I feel like, I don't know, I could believe, if I imagined the other half of that conversation he was having with the chandelier people, I could believe them being like, well, you do know that this is really expensive because of blah, 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 blah. But the that last sentence where he's literally like looking up into the sky and being like, there must be someone who can give me a better deal. And Del's like hiding around the corner going, that is like Panto-esque. I do agree. Yeah. But I found the whole concept of it though, like, really believable, of that Del.
Oh yeah, the concept is completely believable. Yeah. I did quite like when he shoves the cat in his face, David Jason has a little sing song.
What is it? No, it's the tune, isn't it? How much is that dog in the window? The one with the waggly tail.
Yes, I know.
I actually thought it was, I know that's a really small thing to pick up on, but I thought David Jason sung that pretty well. And I was just wondering if we didn't really hear him sing when he's not drunk. Like, we hear him sing, he sings quite often when he's had a few. And I think he's always quite playing it down. But I think that David Jason actually can sing. Just from that tiny little bit there, there's something about it, it tickled me. I was like, I think he's probably got a good voice.
I got a feeling it came up in his autobiography about maybe that,
I was gonna ask that.
Fatal Extraction, that he actually can't sing. Or he thinks he can't.
Oh, yeah.
But I can't remember, so I'm not going to. It's been a while since I read it. But I've got a feeling he seemed to think he can't. But I agree, he's clearly one of those who's not so bad that they can't pretend they can blag it. But I don't think he's secretly got a great voice, but he definitely isn't tone deaf.
Okay.
After that moment, we then cut into the hallway where they're all having a little natter. They're finally being pushed out of the door, almost literally. There is actually here my favourite line in the episode, I think. Which, just because of who we've had a bit of a go at Lady Ridgemore, but her reaction is just absolutely epic, and it is this line here.
I mean, this is beautiful, isn't it, mate? Bet you've held a few balls in here, my lady.
What? Yes, we have.
I just love...
It is a great devil on top.
Yeah, I love how you can 100% get away with that on any time of day in TV, because I definitely wouldn't have picked up on that as a, you know, 8-year-old or whatever the hell I would have been when I first watched it. And yeah, her reaction is just excellent. And then she cuts straight back to being clean. I thought that was brilliant.
It's funny that double entendre, because it's actually, loads of French in this episode. So as he walks out into the hall, he says toujours la politesse, which is always politeness. Then he does a double entendre, and then after they've had the talk, so about paying for the cat, and he says à la mode, which is fashionable, which means simply fashionable.
Okay, I thought I'd heard that expression before, but I couldn't work out where from. Didn't think it was going to be that, but I believe you.
Yeah, I think it's like associated with like perfumes or obviously fashion. So you might
I might just know it from Only Fools and Horses. Quite frankly, I think he says it a lot.
And then Del does a really like cool character thing where he knows the game. He's got a whole lay of the line. He's just done the hook, line, and sinker, and now he's doing the turn and walk away and don't look back. And he exclamates again another French phrase and says, "I'm going to say bon bouche," which is good mouth, and just, you know, he's that's it. He's about to go, and he's obviously called back by Lady Ridgemore, who has inevitably decided that he wants to get Del in front of the drink, and he's going to offer him did he offer him some port?
A nice bottle of port, which is always a good way to keep anyone hanging around. It would certainly work on me.
And Grandad and Rodney are like just jaw dropped, no idea what's going on. And we get a brilliant little wink from Del just as he goes through the door, and he looks back and he winks.
What?
That's fucking great.
What I really liked about this was out of nowhere, Grandad suddenly knows how to go along with a lie, because Del starts doing that whole thing where he's listing off, like, you know, going through the script, and he's like asking Grandad, and he's like, "Yeah, if you like." And then obviously Rodney plays along and stuff like that. It's interesting that Grandad had finally figured out the game, or maybe that was just so obvious that even Grandad couldn't cock that one up.
I think he's like cued almost, like he's given the answer, he's fed it. Like, that's right, isn't it, Grandad? And like, he just needs to be like, yeah.
Yeah, that would be a difficult one to cock up, I admit. But it's an interesting scene. So he's set up saying that he can clean the chandeliers. And so then we cut back to the flat where they're discussing this. Del has managed to agree a fee, apparently, for £350 to clean the chandeliers. Which, is it just me, or is that really low? Like, he knows the price he was offered was £1,200, and Lord Ridgemere thought that was too much. He's gone in at a quarter of that price. He could have gone in at half, surely. I feel like he's undercut himself. He could have gone for a nice round £500, and I reckon Lord Ridgemere is still biting his hand off.
I have this, one of the many things I did in my life was I did sales for quite a while, and I have this thing in my head that that most of Dale's pricing, the way that he does everything, is like just grossly undercutting. Like, he doesn't ever go, like, you know, if someone says I'll offer you for a grand, he doesn't ever say 900 or 800 or 700. It's always like, oh, I'll do it for 250.
Yeah.
You know, and the deals that he picks up is the same. Like, oh, you know, that's worth, you know, 100 quid. I paid tenner for it. Like, he doesn't work in
small margins.
Those close small margins. Yeah. It is a big margin, big savings. He just wants. He's going to do a shit job, and he's kind of pricing it. He's overpricing what he's doing, but he's not like taking the piss. He's kind of getting away with it. I mean, he has said that he's supposed to be, you know, generations.
Well, this is what I mean. It's almost like making your story unbelievable because you cannot be that cheap. Like, it's almost giving it away that you're a cowboy when you're that cheap, I feel. So it was a bit of an odd one.
But he's obviously done it on a spiel, isn't he? He's gone and had a chat with him in the boardroom with some port, and he's like, no, I'll do you a special price. But I think the whole game is here, is he's doing it so cheap because he is viewing this as the start of a new empire. You know, this is preliminary, or the pilot to a huge idea that he's going to be going around. You've got him rocking back and forth on the chair, like, hey, tally ho, and all this sort of stuff. And you know, he thinks he's going to be in with the realm, as it were. I mean,
do you think he genuinely believes this? Because this is like he has a little monologue here where he says, you know, I've always been a trier, I deserve a bit of the good life, etc. And he really tries to say to Rodney, and Rodney even asks him straight towards the end of the scene, like, do you really believe this? This is actually our shot at something completely random and out of the blue. And it does seem like he really does believe it against all the times that things have gone wrong. He's like, yeah, we are going to, out of nowhere, with no experience, going to become nationally renowned chandelier repairers, and that is going to make us rich. Like,
of course he believes it wholeheartedly. Like, just because he's not clever enough to understand why he shouldn't. Like, for him, he can polish glass with Windoline. Job done. No worries. I think he believes it without a single doubt in his mind. I actually really like that monologue as well. I wanted to actually to sample some of it but it was again really long. I didn't know. I wasn't sure when you'd come in and when you'd come out. But it was a really really quite interesting monologue. But yeah, for sure, he knows exactly. He wholeheartedly believes it.
And to be fair, cutting to the next scene, they arrive looking the business, like. They arrive.
What? Because they got white overalls.
Well, I mean, for them, I mean, they come. They've got two. They've got like a. You expect them just to turn up in whatever. But they, yeah, they've got the overalls. They've got a couple of big ass ladders. They've got a couple of toolboxes. They've got the sheet. Wallace is asking questions about why you're removing floorboards, and Dell's like, "Boom! This is why. Attached here with a nut. You need to get that up." Like, he clearly put in some work. He's not just turning up and going, "Fuck! What do we do now?" Like. He's already worked out how it's fitted there. He's already worked out how he's going to get it down. Couple of ladders and a massive sheet. He's brought the tools.
Oh, I don't deny that he's... I mean, it's all pretty, you know, it's all pretty self-explanatory. You haven't got to do a lot of research to know how that's working. I think saying they look at the business...
Sorry. Wallace has been walking past it for the last probably 100 years and has never thought about it.
Yeah, but he's a butler, mate. I mean, he's a butler for a reason. hasn't got any sort of lateral thinking, has he? That's why he's asking stupid bloody questions. It's not held on there by the god of power of grace or Duddy's double-sided sticky tape, as he
yeah,
says.
It's a great line as well. But I thought it was interesting. It's how, yeah, they turned up. They look like, okay, I wonder what's going, you know, obviously everyone's expecting something to go wrong. But they turn up, they look fairly organised. And, yeah, I mean, we're really just building up to it now, really, aren't we?
Yeah, I think they look all right. They look the part. I wouldn't say they look the business. Like, if it was someone charging $1,200 in the day, they'd be coming with, like, really refined toolboxes and, like, you know, special equipment. And they'd be setting that up all around. And, you know, it would be quite the spread, but they're certainly passing for it to a layman like Wallace. They don't know. So little drop of interesting trivia on this one. So we did talk about it earlier, but the scouted location for this was a school in Dorset. I think it was called Claymore School. But they wouldn't let them bring up the floorboards. So when Grandad goes up to do the floorboards, it's actually the girlfriend of Ray Butt's house, which is just
random.
An interesting concept. Yeah, indeed.
I like those really shitty parts of TV making that you hear about. It's like this one scene that's just intertwined with other things. You hear his voice, you assume they're together, and then you find out that this was filmed miles away on a completely different day in some completely random and unrelated location. Like, yeah, to the layman, I just find that sort of stuff like really, really interesting.
As we're slowly building up to it, Grandad's talking about turning the screw, and Dell and Rodney are like, no!
Yeah, that's the little...
not even at the bloody ladders yet.
That's the little foreshadowing there, isn't it? Like, I think the way this scene is built up and the tension is built up is absolutely spot on. They don't really... I think you assume something's going to go wrong because it has to, but you kind of have no idea what it's going to be. And this is just 100% shock value. It's just brilliantly done. They're kind of waiting there, holding the blanket under the ladder. I mean, they're way too far away. I don't know if you thought that straight away. Like, where they're holding the blanket under the chandelier.
Yeah.
It's dropped about half a metre. Like, that's going to just go up one more step.
I don't know how much that would weigh, but I always thought that. I always thought it would weigh enough that you'd, you know, that's a lot of weight just suddenly coming in. You'd want to take some of the force. But I did like that shot. The camera angle's really nice. You're looking at them both through the chandelier.
Very tense.
And they're both, like, super, super tense. Mm. And, like, you're right there, Rodney. You know, you got it all good going there.
You're right. The through the chandelier bit is really helps because you see the delicateness of it. That's a good shout. That's a particularly like important shot to get the tension.
Hear a bit of clinking in the glass and stuff, and you know, you get to like the more common trivia now that a lot of people do know. So I mean, the chandelier was obviously a fake, but it was purpose built for the episode. So the prop is actually worth £6,000.
Did you? Yeah, know? I did. Yeah,
this, I assumed you did.
This is a
so if we're thinking story. About that. So the proper, if we assume that you could buy a really shitty flat in London for £8,000, that means that prop is worth 3/4 of the price of a house. Well, a flat.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an expensive prop. That's real, real expensive. They must have blown a whole series worth of budget on that one.
Well, prop. They did, right? That was basic. That's kind of basically the story as it goes. That the anecdote is. The entire series, in a way, rested on this one shot because they had one opportunity to get it right. And if they didn't, the episode was screwed. And if you can't release, they promised 7 episodes. So if they completely screw it up, they don't have enough episodes. And that puts the entire series in jeopardy. Like, the entire series really does hold on this one shot. Don't fuck it up. Don't laugh. Don't do anything stupid. So the tension's real. The tension is really, really real. Like, you hear it, and I've heard, like, yeah. They talk about it in the autobiography, and I've had interviews with Nick Lindhurst as well about it. Like, they are really nervous.
Mm. I did read that, you know, Ray Button said that they obviously couldn't laugh because they would ruin stuff. But in actuality, they had, like, multiple camera angles, so they probably could have worked around it. But the tension was, they didn't necessarily know that. And there's obviously... not no room for error, but there was a very small margin for error. So loads of tension there.
Then suddenly we get a new camera angle looking long ways down the hallway, and you quickly cut up. Well, at first you cut up to Grandad smashing the hammer down on the bolt, fucking hard, by the way. So they were definitely,
which took a few attempts as
well. Yeah, right. He missed. Is that right? The first time he struggled to like get it bang on.
A few times.
So I like I said before, I think they definitely would have dropped it anyway. But you cut down, you get that long view, and you see the second chandelier out of nowhere. You've not seen it. There's been no reference to it for ages, falling down and smashing into a million pieces, and the audience going into absolute hysterics.
I just want to leave that there for a second. Mm. It's such a brilliantly done finale. Like everything we just talked about, how what has come to it, like the small margin for error, the cost involved in it, the shots that they're using to do it, the close shots, that longer shot in the thing, and then changing from Grandad to Dylan Rodney, and then when it smashes, it isn't. Epic smash, like it falls and just goes everywhere.
I really think the directing is very underrated in this. Generally, Only Fools and Horses is very simply shot. There isn't that much like very clever stuff. But I should have checked. I don't think this was directed by anyone different, this episode. I assume not. But you had that arty stuff with the van going through the fields. And then this shot with the, you know, shooting through the chandelier. And then that long shot. Like, it's really well done. A lot of this stuff is not nearly as effective if you shoot it differently. But it's just perfectly done. And it's fantastic. Like you say, the smash is awesome. And just the shock... I'm not even sure what they say because you can barely hear them over the laughter of the audience.
Sing over what they said because I did listen to it in my head. I just had to watch it because I couldn't remember. But the laughter of the crowd goes on forever. Like it's not. It's obviously a big laugh, but this is chuckling just rippling through just for keeps ages. Going. And then. Yeah, and Del just so heartbroken, he says,
"Bob was undoing the other chandelier."
How can you tell?
That was it. How could you tell? Yeah. Nice.
And they just really, really sheepishly and slowly come down the ladders, and then comes probably the second best bit.
They're coming down the ladder, holding the blankets very carefully still, because they're just in shock. They're just so unprepared for the situation that they found themselves in, that they're just like still in that autopilot mode of, okay, it's almost like they've got it, and they come down and they're shocked. And then, like you say, yeah, the best moment, pot-bellied granddad, smug as a bug in a rug, wandering down the stairs.
He's almost coming down like he almost comes down like Conor McGregor when he comes into the ring. You know, he's got that wide
giving it a strut.
He comes in, and even though it's only like a 1 second shot that he comes down the stairs, you're just drawn to his face, and he's just got this proper shitty grin. He's just so happy with it.
He's so chuffed with himself, isn't he?
I guess you know where the story originally came from as well, and how it all came about.
Go ahead if you've looked at that one. I'm sure
it seems like a lot of the stories that John Sullivan writes comes from his own personal experience, and like I know that the best comedy stuff always comes from stuff like that, but he just has some wild stories, hey?
And specifically his dad as well. I think this is the third time that there's been a story that is specific to his dad rather than something that happened to him as well.
Yeah, our dad's done some crazy stuff. Maybe we should write some. Maybe we should write some stories about it.
Not a bad chant.
The story originally came from his father, as we said. He was a plumber, and essentially exactly the same thing happened. So they had to remove a chandelier, remove the wrong one, and smashed it. And that was initially going to be the end of the episode. Hey, they initially got told that they had to wait there for 30 seconds while credits rolled, and then. You know, as we've said a few times, John Sullivan's sort of added one extra little laugh in there, which is built up by Wallace coming in and says, it's broken. He goes, what the hell do you know what chandelier is anyway? Which is just a really nicely delivered line.
I was going to try and sneak in. It's probably not as good as some of the others, but just because we haven't done one and it is as good a line as anything to kind of sum up the episode. As a suggestion for a Leonard legendary line.
Don't you worry, Jill. Leave it to me.
Very nice. Very nice indeed.
All right, dear boy.
All right? What do you mean, all right? Look at it.
Did you drop it then?
Big fan of that line, and also equally as good in a way, again just because of delivery, Rodney's reply, the voice he has when he gives that reply, it's like it's cracking and it's straining, and there's just all this disbelief and pain and anguish in it, and I think it's beautiful.
Del asks Wallace if they have his number to get hold of him. He says no, and that's it, they're gone, they scarp her and run after the van. Delboy's put his foot down, and Rodney just, I don't know if it is Rodney, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is actually Nicholas Lyndhurst.
Yeah, that was my question as well.
I couldn't find anything there to say either way, but let's assume that it potentially is him jumping the... It probably isn't really, is it? The problem was certainly using a stunt double. But the stunt double jumps in the car and it pulls away. Roll credits. But he's the one who's driving me berserk. Why do only fools and old cities work? La 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 la. So end of the episode, Touch of Glass. Any musings, any thoughts?
I think it's very good. Obviously the big scene at the end, it is always the number two. You know, best scene, Only Fools and Horses, arguably number two most famous scene in English sitcom comedy history. And it's there for a reason. It 100% deserves it. It's a fantastic scene. As I said before, I don't think there are that many, like, big laugh-out-loud moments. Almost disappointingly few laugh-out-loud moments in this episode overall. But it snickers along. It's fun. I really enjoyed it. And it has that, you know, the big saving at the end. So overall, I think it's a really solid episode.
Yeah, I think exactly the same. It was it was a really, really strong episode. There aren't the bigger laughter moments, but it's like constantly niggling away, constantly bat, 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 loads of really cool laughs going on there. Really like the tempo and the writing for everything. I thought it was really well written, as always, with John Sullivan. I think it's all believable. It seems a bit random that they're probably 2 hours outside London, but again, it's just all worked really well. I think it's a brilliant episode. The extras, which we do touch on a bit, probably did all their jobs really well. Nothing seemed too out of place or too corny there. It could be the button on... the whole series has been really good. I've literally loved this series in general. I'm looking forward to the next episode, though.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I am. It's another Christmas special, isn't it? It's although it's a Christmas special that isn't really about Christmas, unlike the other one. Like, it's not a... And it was only released about, I think, 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks later, as opposed to being like a big break. It's like it's a Christmas special, but it's not like they've been away for a long time. I assume it was all kind of filmed at the same time. So it's almost like just an episode 8 of the series. But it is Diamonds Are for Heather, is our next episode. It's got a bit of a Long Legs of the Law. No, not Long Legs of the Law.
No Greater Love.
No Greater Love, yes. It's got a bit of a No Greater Love sort of thing about it. Some of these early ones where they have the relationships, I'm not sure they do them that great. I still don't think Annie Falls is very good with the female characters yet. Certainly not one I'm remembering too fondly.
No, it's funny that you say it now that I have looked at the episode name. I actually thought it was a different one. I'm actually not looking forward to it.
No.
I don't think I like this episode at all. I also generally don't like children in the episodes. I don't think they do great things in there, and there is, although the kid's really young and doesn't do anything, it's just another reason not to like it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I think when we've got low expectations, that can be a really good thing. I mean, there hasn't been any episodes that I've actively disliked, but it'd be interesting. I think it'll be a lot to talk about, because if it's maybe not such a strong episode, that brings up criticism, which is an interesting discussion. So, I hope everyone will be back to join us for that next episode.
So that's it. Another episode, Licked and Sticked. Hope you enjoyed A Touch of Glass as much as we did. Join us next week for Diamonds Are for Heather. And, of course, I'm only going to leave you with one little bit of music today, which was mentioned in the episode. Cheesy as, but it's going to be... How much is that? Doggy in the Window.
Get in.
Brilliant, eh?
It is. That's a good shout. I was wondering if you'd do that. All right. I'll see you later, Jay.
Right. I look forward to some much easier and on-time recordings from next week, Bob.
Me too, mate. Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook /OnlyFoolsBrothers or on Twitter, we're @OnlyFoolsBros. Or if you want to send us a longer message, you can email us at OnlyFoolsBrothers@gmail.com. Also, really appreciate it if you could give us some sort of rating or review on your podcast app of choice. Thanks very much. Goodbye.
The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope